Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, this is Pod Save the UK.
I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan.
This week, the honeypot scandal that's been engulfing Westminster.
Special guest Shami Chakrabarti tells us why we need human rights.
And we explain why Rishi Sunak has ruined shoes.
So, Nish, I've been on holiday, so I've come back to learn that British MPs are extremely horny. What is going on?
Okay, this is a quite complicated and at points extremely strange story. On Thursday last week, the MP for Hazel Grove in Greater Manchester, William Ragg, announced that 2 years ago, he exchanged messages on a dating app and the person he was speaking to started asking for the phone numbers of other MPs. Worried about the messages and also the kind of content this person had from him, Ragg obliged. And since he went public with this, we've learned that several MPs, parliamentary staffers and Westminster journalists subsequently received near identical messages.
Right, okay. So what was it, like a phishing scam?
Yes, effectively, yes. It was a phishing scam that unfortunately involved compromising photos of a member of parliament. I think that's absolutely as much as we need to say.
Okay, and how many people have been...
So we're now up to 21, according to Politico. And the whistle was first blown on this a month ago by Dr. Luke Evans, who's a Conservative MP for Bosworth in Leicestershire, who took a slightly different tack to William Ragg when he was sent sexually explicit images, as he explained in a video on his Facebook page.
A month ago, I was a victim of cyber flashing and malicious communications and blew the whistle by reporting it to the police and the parliamentary authorities as soon as this happened. The first set of messages I got was on a day I was with my wife, and I got a one-time open photo on WhatsApp of an explicit image of a naked lady. As soon as I got these, the next day I reported it to the police, the authorities, and the chief whip. 10 days later, I got another set of messages. This time, however, I was sat with my team in the constituency office, so we were able to record the conversation and catch photos and videos of the messages coming through, including another explicit female image.
The reaction to all of this in Westminster has been mixed. Here's Chancellor Jeremy Hunt talking to Sky News.
Well, I think the events of the last few days have been a great cause for concern. The MP involved has given a courageous and fulsome apology. But the lesson here for all MPs is that they need to be very careful about cybersecurity.
Listen, I will say this. I do think William Ragg has been placed in an unfortunate position, and Lord knows there are many of us out there that have fallen variety to a huge range of phishing scams and all this kind of stuff. I would say courageous is maybe stretching it a little bit. You would like to think that you wouldn't give out people's numbers, especially if you're a member of parliament. One of the MPs, Andrea Jenkins, whose number he did give out, has called Ragg an idiot. But the message from the sort of leadership of the Conservative Party has maybe been to not take this as seriously as perhaps they should. Instead of being fired by Rishi Sunak, Ragg was actually allowed to resign the Conservative whip, meaning that he'll sit as an independent for the rest of this parliament, as well as resigning as the vice chair of the 1922 committee and the chair of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee. He'd already announced that he wouldn't be standing again at the next election. So that's already been out there. But he's just sort of going to be hanging around Westminster, and he's going to be voting on things like the online safety bill, which he supported. But I'm beginning to worry that he's not qualified to have an opinion on online safety.
Well, he's popular, isn't he, William Ragg? He's considered a sensible person. And given some of the people in the Conservative Party, I can understand why a sensible person is probably being rallied around. So maybe that's behind, like, maybe that informs why people are being quite kind about it. But there are some serious questions here. Who is behind this? Who is sending these phishing messages?
I mean, there's a theory that it could be a foreign power, though some international security experts said it doesn't fit the pattern of intelligence operations undergone by the Kremlin to sort of infiltrate foreign powers. It could just be criminals, basically, trying to blackmail MPs for money or influence. It is a difficult thing because it is a really serious subject, but it does involve penises. The important thing for the British press and all of us covering the story to do is to try and keep our mind on the fact that there's quite serious security implications here and not the fact that it involves penises.
It's difficult though, because I keep having this image in my head of like...
penises?
No, of people like in the Kremlin in a secure room around a table with a whiteboard, like brainstorming ideas of how to infiltrate Britain. And it's just like, have you considered the horn dogs?
Can we just quickly circle back to whatever accent that was? What? In the name of God, it sounded like you were about to threaten James Bond.
No, that's what I was going for. Yeah, I was going for like James Bond villain. Just sort of, you don't know where they're from. Doesn't matter. Don't think about it.
Somewhere in Central Europe.
Is a villainous person.
We can't quite pin it down.
But anyway, we all know that horniness is a vulnerability. That's true. That's a lesson for us all.
I believe is one of the core messages of this podcast. if we were allowed to get merch made with the word horniness on it, horniness is a vulnerability would be one of the keynote messages of Pod Save the UK. But let's move on from this to the Shadow Health Secretary, Labour's Wes Streeting, who wrote an article in The Sun this week, a newspaper that some of us have not a favourable view of, and I include myself and the entire city of Liverpool for that. We don't have time to go into the backstory of that, but just Google The Sun and Liverpool, and it's a particularly unsavoury story about why that newspaper is not popular in that city. And that city is entirely justified in its opinion on that newspaper, in my opinion. This week, Wes Streeting wrote an article in said shitrag about how plans to pay private healthcare providers to carry out NHS services are going to be a core part of Labour's offering on the NHS at the election. The thing that really jumped out at me before we get into the substance of this is a point in the article where he has a go at what he calls middle-class lefties. So this is the full quote here. Middle-class lefties cry betrayal. The real betrayal is the two-tier system that sees people like them treated faster while working families like mine are left waiting for longer. So the accusation Streeting is making is that these hypothetical middle-class lefties have access to private healthcare and then spend their time saying that we should have less private influence in the NHS, but they are operating in a two-tier system. I don't understand why there is so much energy being expended by the Labour Party slagging off its own voters. Labour may well win this election very, very easily, right? But at some point in the ensuing 5 years, they are going to need to be shored up by their core support. The next government is going to inherit an absolute shitstorm of an intray, okay? And the second the Labour Party take power, the Conservative opposition is going to jump down its throat for being responsible for a series of crises that were engineered by the Conservative government, okay? And at that point, when we come to, say, some local elections, you're in real danger of having alienated people that you will need to prop you up.
And it's so unnecessary. You could have made your point, which I don't actually agree with Wes Streeting, but nonetheless, you could have made it. You didn't need to go there.
I'm also just fascinated by who these sort of middle-class lefties are.
Exactly.
I sort of don't really know who.
Well, that's been made up, isn't it? This homogenous group has been made up by the right. They've adopted the language of it, and they've sort of made this non-truth a truth. It's scary. And let's just imagine for a minute that there is a homogenous group called the middle class lefty, right?
Yeah.
Like, so let's imagine them. Like, I don't actually believe that they're really incensed about this idea of working class people having access to private services out of their sort of idealistic, ideologically driven. It's more just this very obvious fact that the more you privatise the NHS, the closer you are to seeing the NHS disappear completely. That's all it is. You know what I mean? And I just feel like it's disingenuous suggesting that this group of people have an opinion that actually you've not represented fully fairly. And also, who is this group?
the other thing about Streeting's article, which was actually the substance of it, was that he said Labour wanted to reform the NHS, by which he means, and I quote, put artificial intelligence technology in every hospital. I think there's a huge debate about AI. There's lots of sections of the healthcare industry that are concerned about it. There's lots of sections that we should say are very, very excited about it. It's a question that will need to be asked and need to be drilled down into. In the interim, may I suggest that whilst we wait to see what the implications are of AI for hospitals, we use AI to write Wes Streeting's fucking newspaper articles for him, because they can't be any worse than what the real guy's churning out.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Our guest this week is Baroness Shami Chakrabarty. She's worked as a human rights lawyer, and as you can tell from the slight exhalation you might have heard there, is thrilled to be referred to as Baroness. She was the director of the charity Liberty that works to challenge injustices and was the shadow attorney general under Jeremy Corbyn. Her new book is called Human Rights, The Case for the Defence, described as a powerful and urgent explanation and vindication of our human rights and freedoms. It comes out on the 2nd of May. Shami, as I have been instructed by you to call you, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
I never thought a part of my life would be navigating the honorifics for people in the House of Lords.
Well, I mean, I think most of the sensible people know the best way of navigating is to ignore. And I think we take our lead from Alf Dubs, do we not?
Alf Dubs.
Who, you know, who is, I think, I would say the David Attenborough of human rights.
Yeah.
And if it's good enough for him... If Alf is good enough for Alf, Shami's got to be good enough for Shami.
Before we get into the book, there's one big story that's been sort of dominating the headlines in regards to the House of Commons this week. MPs being targeted with explicit messages after the now independent William Ragg handed out his colleagues' personal phone numbers. Can you give us a sense of how big a security breach this is? How substantial are the tools or the training in place to prevent this happening to MPs?
Obviously, I'm not an MP. I'm in I'm at the other end. I do... You know, whatever the party politics and the politics, I do feel a bit sorry for William Ragg. And we know that even before this technology that we're all now in a way subject to, entrapment has always been real.
Yeah.
And I think that entrapment was always possible. Humans are always vulnerable. But the vulnerability is turbocharged by the proliferation, intimate nature of this technology that's in your pocket.
Do you have any thoughts on the idea that this could be the work of some sort of foreign power?
Well, there's always that concern.
Yeah. Mm.
Here's an interesting question. In the world of this new technology, what does paranoia look like? Back in the day, when I was, for example, first director of Liberty, classic paranoia would be, I think everybody's watching me. I think everybody's listening to me. Mm-hmm. I think foreign powers are listening to me, watching me. What does paranoia look like when there's an element of truth in that?
Yeah.
Because of the proven attempts by bad actors, including state powers, including organised criminals, scammers, fraudsters, to do that. I think it's a serious issue, not just for our security, but for our mental health, emotional well-being, our trust issues, and so on. It's about all of us and this technology, and whether we allow it to carry on being this unregulated space. It's like a new continent without sheriffs. It's not properly governed, and we're nowhere close. The technology moves apace. We're not catching up quickly enough with our conversation, with our politics, with our law.
You talk about that in your book, don't you? The internet technology, is this like the area we should be really putting our mind into?
This is, the book has a bit of history and a bit of philosophy in the beginning just to explain how human rights arrived.
Yeah.
But the big three final chapters of the book are about applying human rights to the current existential challenges, and they are tech and AI, mm-hmm. they are war and peace, and they are climate.
Yeah.
And I think that the tech, the tech stuff also cuts into both war and climate. And if we're not careful and we don't catch up, huge decisions are being made about all of us, even now. Not just banking and insurance and health and policing. These decisions are being made inside a black box that is owned not by the state, however imperfect your government is, it's owned by a private contractor.
Yeah.
And we can't see in the black box. So we don't know what was in the algorithm. Mm. And an algorithm is a bit like a law. It's a list of instructions that that then determine what happens to you or how the decision is made, except this is not legible. We can't see what this list of instructions is. And already, as I found terrifyingly when researching the book, huge injustices have been perpetrated. We know about the postmasters.
Yeah.
Mm. Let's have that tattooed onto our souls, because this potentially is just the beginning of the injustices that are possible hidden in the black box, hidden in, oh, the computer's infallible. But I want a human decision. I want a transparent decision that I can challenge in case it's wrong.
Given what you've said about, you know, AI, climate, war and peace, and those being how we need to apply human rights, and all of those things concern Britain very strongly at the moment, I wonder if you can answer this question for me that I've had on my mind for ages. How good is Britain at human rights? Like, where would you rank us? Like, how are we doing against our...
I think we're plunging. Look, so I think the history is mixed. Britain did slavery. Britain was part of abolishing slavery, blah, blah, blah. And I touch on some of that stuff in my book. But as of now, what I would say is in the post-war period, mm-hmm. particularly straight after World War II, Winston Churchill was not a perfect dude. He has all kinds of issues in his story.
Fan of Indians.
Or at one stage, women. You know, he would post suffrage before he changed. So there's all of that. But he, with others after World War II, has to have some credit, some significant credit for thinking that human rights had to be part of the end game, part of what we do next after 1945. Credit where it's due. And I would say there was a bipartisan consensus in British politics for some years around human rights, not just civil and political rights like the Convention on Human Rights, but also social and economic rights like the NHS, the welfare mm-hmm. state, universal state education, at least, you know, at least firstly for primary kids and then so it's a mixed history, mm-hmm. but I think there was a good story to tell about the post-war consensus. And now in recent years, certainly since 2016, we've taken a plunge.
Right.
I think the global picture, because nothing is national anymore, right? Yes. It's a shrinking, burning planet. Nothing just happens here. And I think the rise of the populist far right all over the planet is deeply troubling and a real concern for human rights. And not just the populist far right. People's Republic of China ain't so much for the people as far as I'm concerned. So I think there is a... You know, that's why I wrote this book, mm-hmm. because I think this is a really, really challenging moment for anybody who believes in fundamental rights and freedoms. I did not expect at this stage in my life or my career to have to be not just arguing about whether this case is right or wrong, but about whether human rights themselves are right or wrong, whether we should pull out of the Convention on Human Rights, the most successful human rights instrument in world history. Astonishing.
And that's, we should be clear, what the Conservative government is threatening to do to pass the Rwanda bill, because it finds itself, you know.
So Mr. Sunak is now calling, one of his mantras is that the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, a creature of the Council of Europe that was founded by the Treaty of London in 1949, that this is a foreign court. So instead of international, we use the word foreign. It was recognised by the Refugee Convention that some of the most genuine refugees have to sneak away with forged papers in the backs of boats and lorries as stowaway. That's what a desperate refugee sometimes has to do to escape, yeah. which is why the Refugee Convention says you can't penalise somebody for the means of escape. And that is what is now stop the boats. That's what we're going to do. If you don't, we don't care how genuine you are. We don't care if you were an Afghan translator for yeah. the British. Yeah. You got here in a boat. Your asylum claim is not going to be considered here at all, right? So the British courts are defenestrated. Even in the wake of a British Supreme Court decision last autumn saying, we don't think that Rwanda is currently safe, right? And then when the British courts have no power to deal with these cases, the only court left will be the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, to which Mr. Sunak says, foreign court. I'm going to ignore a foreign court. So do you see what is going yeah. on here? It is such a swindle. It is it's a grander swindle even than the one that Nigel Farage and co pulled off. That was nothing compared to this. We will rob people in the UK of their human rights in the name of stopping the boats. It ain't stopping the boats, it's stopping the courts.
But then, and then there's these further calls to leave the European Convention on Human Rights
yeah.
as well. Doesn't it also have implications for the Northern Ireland and the Republic of
yes,
Ireland as well?
It does.
Can you just explain that briefly for us?
So when I was a young lawyer, as we know, some years ago, I had the privilege of doing a tiny bit of work on what became the Good Friday Agreement. And looking back on all of that, my view is now that one of the things that made it possible was that, yes, you could choose which tradition you were in. You could think of yourself as British or Irish or both, but everyone was going to be European. And that sort of helped. That the fact that both the UK and the Republic of Ireland were in the European Union probably helped. But even more important, it was written in to that agreement that both sides would respect the European Convention on Human Rights and that the European Convention on Human Rights would be enforceable within Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Now, if the UK walks out, we throw that treaty into jeopardy once more. And we saw the callous way that some of the arch-Brexiteers treated the Good Friday Agreement and Northern Ireland during the whole Brexit affair. And now this will be even worse. The people that are currently in charge of our country just don't care. They are reckless vandals and hooligans who care not for the domestic or the international rule of law. And this sounds a bit esoteric, the rule of law. What is the rule of law? Well, you can't tell your kids that they have to respect the local magistrates or the criminal law against shoplifting or whatever it is, if the Prime Minister doesn't respect the Supreme Court, the Court of Human Rights, international treaties. That's my view. It's hypocrisy, and there's nothing worse than hypocrisy if you're trying to inspire mutual respect.
Let's talk about the Labour Party. You know, looking forward to the end of the year when there's a general election, there's still an assumption that Labour is going to form the next government. I wanted to read this email that we've had from a listener, Paul, on Keir Starmer, and it says this: I am a 31-year-old English voter living in Wales and have voted Lib Dem, Labour and Plaid Cymru at various points in my life. My question is, what do people see in Keir Starmer that I'm missing? Am I blind to the good parts of what he's offering, or is he offering nothing at all? What's your evaluation of Keir Starmer as a potential future Prime Minister?
So, obviously, this is the hot button question, isn't it? I have known Keir for a long time. He has been a lawyer and a manager for a lot longer than he's been a politician. And I'm not, you know, a very long time politician. And by the way, I've never been elected to a parish council or a PTA. So he's got one up on me. I think the values are there. I think, you know, he prides himself as having been a human rights lawyer. He's certainly been a lawyer for many years. And I think it's important that he keeps listening to that to that inner core. I think the question was, what do people see in Keir Starmer? I think after years of maladministration, people were probably quite looking for a safe pair of hands.
Yeah.
That's not a terrible, even, you know, the idealistic Chakrabarti is not going to say, oh, a safe pair of hands, that's a bad idea. What we need to do is have a party and burn the house down. So I think a safe pair of hands is fine as long as, you know, those values keep beating very, very hard, and we never listen to some of the, you know, siren voices who say, oh, don't be too much a human rights lawyer, for example, because that's what the Tories are going to attack you for.
Yeah.
And that's not his fault, but I think all of us, there comes a point with this stuff where you have to go and have the fight. You can't keep running away from it because they're not, because it's not running away from you, whether it's immigration, human rights, all these so-called progressive issues. I understand why it's tempting to duck the issue if you're going to be attacked for your background and your history on that issue. But I think we kind of got into this pickle in this country because progressives ducked some of these issues for too long and created space for the far right to take over the Tory party and put us in the position that we are now.
And that, but there's kind of two issues that I want to piggyback on the back of that, because I feel exactly the same as you on so many things that you just said. And it's part of the reason why I found it so concerning that, you know, a qualified human rights lawyer like Keir Starmer was, you know, on LBC essentially defending Israel's right to violate human rights laws in Gaza. To be quite honest with you, after the last 14 years, I would be thrilled with a boring middle manager like that. I think what we want is competence.
But I don't want it to be quoted that I called anybody a boring middle manager.
But yeah.
That's not a fair paraphrase.
To be clear,
I never called anybody a boring middle manager.
That was a spectacular piece of editorialisation.
I better push back.
But in an instant like that,
I think there was an explanation, retraction, qualification, sometime.
Yeah, I struggled to make sense of the qualification.
Well, so, I mean, yeah. It's, you know, that's above my pay grade, as they say. But I do know that under pressure, under intense pressure, people, myself included, will screw up.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Let's think about another story that's been on my mind recently, and I think actually you'll have a great insight on it. It's about Diane Abbott. So Diane Abbott obviously has been a massive target of online and kind of newspaper hate for many, many years. And I have an anxiety that there is going to be a chilling effect. Perhaps it's already happening now, where women of colour are going to come out of the public arena. They are going to be afraid to enter it because it doesn't matter what you say or what you do, you're going to get bombarded. Now, you are a woman of colour. A very prominent one. I'm sure you've had your fair share. What do you think about the impact of the abuse that faces public speaking women of colour?
Well, it's, I mean, you sort of said it all in a way. I just feel very, very sad about it, but it's real.
Yeah.
And it is worse now, right? Like, there's been an uptick.
Well,
I think
think maybe social media has turbocharged it, as we were sort of suggesting before. Mm.
Yeah.
So it's always been there, right? Racism's been there, misogyny's been there, and certainly Diane has faced it 30, you know, has faced it. Amnesty International did an analysis, I think it was in the 2017 mm-hmm. election, and they tried to, and they analysed the internet and analysed the hate that was poured on. What they found was that Diane was getting more of it than everybody else put together. And that, this is a human being. Yeah. Yes, she's brave, and yes, she's brilliant, and yes, she's a pioneer, and all these wonderful words. And it's good that we use all these wonderful words,
right,
but we
absolutely.
Also need to, you know, if you had a friend, she's my dear friend, if you had a dear friend who was doing this, you would, yes, say you're brave, you're brilliant, but you would also put your arm around them and say, but this is unacceptable. Yeah. And if we
course.
Can think this way when it's our friends and family, including when they're having disputes with each other, why can't we apply the same logic to other people's friends and family too?
This is my concern. I genuinely think there's a part of me that might say now, you're a woman of colour, maybe don't do it. For your own safety, for your own well-being. Now, maybe that makes me a coward. And I, you know, I like to think actually if it came down to it, I'd be like, no, girl, go, fight.
Sure.
But it's so horrific.
Yeah, but here's
how do we encourage people to keep going on with this?
Look, I understand. I totally get where you're coming from. But here's the problem with the logic. It's not just that people, that we'll never get past it. It's also that you might apply that logic to what? Women of colour joining the police force? Misogyny and racism are so rife that if we start down that road of telling our friends and family not to put the toe into the water, there won't be much water left for them to swim in, because it's not just politics, is it? We have to have protection and solidarity for people rather than say, oh, just don't go there.
So we should give Diane Abbott the whip back, right? In solidarity.
Of course. Diane lost the whip for a very foolish letter to a newspaper, and her mistake was to compete for victimhood. It was a debate about whose faces the worst racism, blah, blah, which is always a mistake in my view, because racism is racism is racism. The competition for victimhood is a tragic mistake, and she knew it, and she apologised quickly.
Just for clarity, for people who might not be familiar with the specific remarks, Diane Abbott had the whip removed for saying that the racism suffered by Jewish, Roman, Irish people wasn't the same as the racism suffered by black people.
And that's the point. You know, it's very easy when when any of us are feeling hard done by, it's very understandable
it's human,
to think that our pain is worse than your pain. And it's not right, but it's how people feel, particularly when they are in a moment of real hurt and abuse. She apologised very quickly. She was wrong, but she should be allowed back in.
Absolutely. I believe she should have the whip restored. She's apologised. That should be something that happens. And I also think you've referenced something twice that I think is so important to highlight, that this idea that equality is a finite resource.
And they laugh at the rest of us when we buy into all this divide and rule.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's so important that we don't, you know, that we don't accept the terms of conversation as set by oppressors, like that those of us who belong to whatever minority or marginalised community, we don't accept that we have to fight each other for our rights and equality.
I mean, not to, obviously we're all, you know, progressives, we're on the left, so I'm not, and of course we need to do this soul searching, but I think it's the right that have done this. They've set those terms, you know, and it's hard when they're in control. Well, we were talking earlier about Suella Braverman, Rishi Sunak, you know, Priti Patel, and, you know, they are operating within that game. And in order to succeed, they are throwing other people under the bus. And there's a part of me that has like this very high level of emotional anger. And I wonder if actually it's misguided and I should be sort of directing it more at, I don't know who I would direct it at.
I've searched my soul about my feelings about their utterances for quite a long time. And I was concerned. There's always a danger of being particularly cross with your fellow women or your fellow
who have less
Asians
power.
Or whatever. And so when I felt particularly cross with my fellow children of migrants treating refugees in particular in this way, I thought, Shami, are you internalising racism? Are you being crosser with them? Are you crosser with them than, you know, Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson? I'm not. I'm pretty cross with those guys. but having thought about it long and hard, this is what I think. I think a lot of hate and cruelty comes from ignorance. What breaks my heart about Rishi Sunak, Suella Braverman, Kemi Badenoch, they know better. They have experienced, they must have, they have experienced racism. Their parents experienced racism and they know better. They don't have even the mitigation. They say ignorance is no defence. It is at least mitigation, right? They don't have that mitigation.
Quite often the comeback that they might say is, we are racist because we expect people of colour to be left-wing.
I don't expect them to be left-wing. No. This is not about left-wing. The Refugee Convention, the ECHR, these are not left-wing propositions. These were agreed, the Universal Declaration, these were agreed by Democrats across the aisle. Extraordinary piece of statecraft after the war for the United States and the Soviet Union to agree on some of this stuff. So this is not me bashing Tories. It's horrible, horrible distraction from the issues that are really, really affecting people who can't pay their bills, and the NHS is crumbling around them, the schools, you know, teachers are buying sandwiches for the kids. I mean, and then you trash human rights as a sort of distraction from that.
Sorry, no, go on.
But I think what you've said perfectly articulates how a lot of us feel, in that we can totally accept that we shouldn't hold them to high political standards, the conservative people of colour, and we can accept that. But there is also this parallel feeling that we're allowed to have of disappointment and confusion.
Look, I don't
at people
hold
with shared life
to,
experience.
The reason why we have universal rights and freedoms and laws is that everybody's held to the same standard. Yeah. But, you know, when I know that people from their own lived experience know better, then clearly ignorance is no defence.
Do you think we could have a progressive, so maybe Labour, maybe Green, maybe Liberal, whoever it might be, but woman Prime Minister?
Of course.
POC Prime Minister? You think?
Of course.
Yeah?
Just because things have been a certain way doesn't mean they always have to be that way. You know, it's high time to have a, you know, perhaps the next leader of the Labour Party should, you know, be a woman. It's probably high time. It's the party of equality. And I'm not saying that there aren't great men around and great women around, but it's going to become a matter of historical embarrassment if the party of equality has, after over 100 years, never had a woman leader.
Before we let you go, I've got a couple of quick questions that I want to ask you in relation to...
It's just like quick fire. It's just like kind of boxes
you.
Or white phones.
Barbie or Oppenheimer?
Chaz or Dave?
Barbie. Easy peasy.
Oh, easy. Not even a moment's hesitation.
Barbie. But I love Christopher Nolan's movies. I thought his Batman movies were even better than Oppenheimer. I think that Barbie is going to be a timeless movie and a very, very interesting political movie.
Really?
The politics of Barbie. I mean, it's Hollywood at its best in a way, with the subversive Hollywood that can do song and dance and glamour and have very, very serious feminist messages there. I think politically it was much more interesting to me than even Oppenheimer, which was a bit of a great man movie and probably cut out too many of the women who were involved in the Manhattan Project. But I think Sir Christopher Nolan is a fabulous filmmaker. But for me, The Dark Knight was perhaps even better than Oppenheimer.
Shabby Chakrabarty is a fan of The Dark Knight on my
and Barbie.
Prediction card.
So we've had a load of emails and TikTok comments about our interview with George the Poet. It was a couple of weeks ago. He talked about voting apathy. So I just wanted to get your opinion on this. So Leoshi commented on TikTok to say, whilst there is little difference between the two parties today, in that small gap, thousands of people die. Meanwhile, Andrea commented on TikTok to say, if you don't vote, you don't get to complain. So look, you're a Labour peer. You're going to say vote Labour, right? Mm. But would you say anything else to people who feel that voting is just no longer an effective way to change the world?
It's not the only way, but people died for this. I mean, I'm going to sound like a you know, an old lady, because I am. And I touch on this in the book again, you know, suffrage struggles all over the world, and they continue to this day, are so fundamental, use it or lose it. You know, whether you use it in a way that I agree with or not, I do think there is something very precious about voting in a country where you can. So I would urge people to vote. And I would also say that the thing about democracy and about movements is that if we're taking on the people on the Learjets and Mount Olympus, they have billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars and pounds, and we just have each other. If you are in mass movement democratic politics, you have to compromise. And I know that's really, really hard, but that is the nature of the thing, which means that some people call it holding your nose and they use all of this. I'm not talking about, I don't want to be as negative as that. Mm-hmm. The nature of mass movement solidarity in politics, by definition, is compromise. Think about the compromises that you strike in your own family or friendship circle over what to have for dinner, let alone how to run the country. If you abstain from one of the most important general elections probably of my lifetime, I think it's a mistake. People must vote. Don't give up this precious, precious freedom, however cynical you're feeling, however angry, whatever. And do the other stuff. Because democracy isn't just voting. We didn't talk about protest rights and mm-hmm, how they've been mm-hmm. clamped down on. And I feel very, very strongly about that. But you have to do the bare minimum as a citizen. If you're lucky enough to be 18 years old and entitled to vote, you vote. And you do all the other stuff as well. We have to do all of these things and never give up. You know, if things can turn badly very quickly, they can turn around quickly too. That is the nature of a volatile political moment. I still have hope.
So what you're saying is sometimes it's darkest just before the dawn.
Totally.
That's a line from The Dark Knight.
Well, I think it probably was inspired by people even before that, if I may say, but you know, what do I know? With great power comes great responsibility.
That's Spider-Man.
That's Spider-Man's uncle.
Shami Chakravarti, thank you so much for joining us.
So now for our hero and villain of the week. And Nish, I believe you have a fallen hero for us. Once a hero, but a hero no more.
I do, Coco. RIP to the Adidas Samba.
Gone, but never forgotten.
For context, the Adidas Sambas are extremely popular trainers. The Evening Standard, a London paper, has said in most cities, you're never more than 6 feet away from a rat. In London, this is true of the Adidas Samba. The Guardian has drawn a parallel to the Converse All-Stars in the 2000s or the Stan Smiths in the 2010s. A retro, casual classic, an archival pub shoe that works almost anywhere. But now they have been felled. And they've been felled by a blow from a single man, Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak did an interview where he wore Adidas Sambas and now they're dead to us all. The video was with Abigail Foster, who's a finance educator, and the first 30 seconds are quite revealing. Let's hear it.
Abby, hi. Hey. That's
very nice to see you.
I was looking at your stuff, and you have a real, it's quite a special talent to be able to explain economic and financial things in a way that's relatable and engaging.
I will remind you, Rishi Sunak was Chancellor of the Exchequer for 2 years. For 2 years. And he is acknowledging that someone else had a better capacity to explain finance and economics to ordinary people. Look, there was an unfortunate incident recently where Rishi Sunak attended a public event wearing some very expensive Prada trainers. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, presumably someone at Conservative Central Office has said, you can't be wearing those trainers again. You got to wear the trainers that everyone's wearing. The trainers everyone's wearing are Adidas Sambas. And, you know, this is a quote from GQ, the style magazine, in a bid to present himself as young and hip and quite possibly the future SVP of a tax-avoiding tech brand, Sunak took an eternally cool sneaker and ruined it for everyone. Even former Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson tweeted, holy shit biscuits, I support the PM, but there is a limit. Is that your limit, Ruth? You still support this Prime Minister, but you'll have a go at him for his trainers. honestly, in an interview with LBC, Rishi Sunak actually did issue an apology.
Well, first of all, I just issue a fulsome apology to the Samba community. But in my defence, I would say I have been wearing Adidas trainers, including Sambas and others, in fact, for many, many years. Actually, the first pair my brother got for me many, many years ago, my first pair of fun Adidas trainers as a Christmas present, and I haven't looked back since.
It's absolutely embarrassing. We need Run DMC to come back to repair the shattered reputation of the Adidas brand in full. But also, it does suggest that if you want an apology from Rishi Sunak, you got to wear Adidas Sambas. So I would suggest, if you're a refugee coming to this country, you better pop a pair of Sambas on, because that's the only way Sunak is going to show you the basic amount of human decency or respect. Coco, who's your villain of the week?
So this week, it is the Department for Work and Pensions. So this relates to a story that The Guardian's been covering for a little while. It's around carers' allowance, a subject, of course, close to my own heart. I'll give you a quick summary of it. In order to claim carers' allowance, you need to be caring for someone for 35 hours a week minimum. So that's a full-time job, isn't it? And the allowance you receive is roughly 80 quid. Now, you are allowed to top that up with a part-time job, but only to the tune of around £120 a week earnings, right? If you go over that amount, you're penalised and you forfeit the whole £80, right? Now, there's many reasons why someone could go over that limit unintentionally. Perhaps they get a pay rise. Perhaps the national minimum wage has been, you know, raised. Perhaps there's an inflationary payout from a company, blah, blah, blah. There's all these different reasons. So lots of carers have been caught up in this mistakenly. You know, they haven't meant to do anything wrong, but they are circumventing these rules, and the Department of Work and Pensions have been extremely aggressive about it. So there's one case in particular that's been recently covered, which really illustrates how cruel and draconian this can be. And it is concerning a lady called Vivian Groom. So Vivian Groom was caring for her mother and receiving carer's allowance. She failed to declare a part-time minimum wage job, should I say, at the co-op to cover some bills. Although she did say she did actually inform the Department of Work and Pensions. Now, Department of Work and Pensions ended up prosecuting her for benefits fraud. She had no legal representation. She pleaded guilty and she received a non-custodial sentence and agreed a repayment schedule. Now, a judge ordered that the Department for Work and Pensions should calculate how much carer's allowance Vivian would have received had she declared this job from the start. But the Department for Work and Pensions refused to calculate the difference. In addition to this, she also received a £16,000 lump sum from her mum that had deceased, the person she was caring for. And so Department for Work and Pensions says, yeah, all right, we'll have that. And in order to claim that money, they used what is called a Proceeds of Crime Act. So where you take illegally gained assets from a criminal. I mean, that's the stuff reserved for gangsters. Yeah. It's the stuff that's reserved for like embezzlers, not people who looked after their dying mother. I think it illustrates that, you know, when the Department of Work and Pensions is so much more concerned with being punishing, essentially, like clamping down on benefits fraud to the point where it's like an obsession, even though it's concerning small amounts. This is what happens. Good people who are, let's be honest, carers save the state a lot of money.
Yep.
You know, there is not enough money being put into social care. All these low paid and so often unpaid carers are keeping this stuff going, keeping the show on the road, saving the NHS enormous amounts of money. It's just really sad. And there's always a human cost. And people like Vivian end up losing the inheritance that they were given from their mother, who left them one parting gift for all their love and help in those painful final years. It's just so bleak. And so, Department for Work and Pensions, you are our villain of the week.
In the interest of airing everyone's right to reply, the DWP told the BBC, "We are committed to fairness in the welfare system while protecting the public purse. Claimants have a responsibility to inform the DWP of any changes in their circumstances that could impact their award, and it is right that we recover taxpayers' money when this has not occurred." If you want to get in touch with us, you can by emailing psuk@reducelisting.co.uk.
Don't forget to follow us at Podsave the UK on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also find us on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. You can drop us a review too, if you like.
Podsave the UK is a Reduce Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer Ed Morrish and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Video editing was by Dave Kaplowitz and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer, Alex Bennett.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.